This is Radio Times. I'm Artie Moscoane. Let me read the first paragraph of Kate Bolick's cover story in the November edition of The Atlantic, an article titled All the Single Ladies. She writes, "In 2001, when I was 28, I broke up with my boyfriend. Alan and I had been together for 3 years, and there was no good reason to end things. He was and remains an exceptional person, intelligent, good-looking, loyal, kind. My friends, many of whom were married or in marriage track relationships, were bewildered. I was bewildered. To account for my behavior, all I had were two intangible yet undeniable convictions. Something was missing. I wasn't ready to settle down." Bolick goes on to describe the next 10 years of her life and why she and other women like her are unmarried and how the institution is being changed by many different forces. Kate Bolick is a freelance writer, and she joins us from Los Angeles. And Kate Bolick, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Hi, thanks. I'm really happy to be here.
Well, we're very happy to have you here. So why did you break up with Alan?
At the time, I was not ready for that level of commitment, and the fact, you know, at that time, that felt very scary and sort of wrong-headed to do. But in retrospect, I understand that there were forces much larger than myself that enabled me to make that decision.
And I do want to get to all those forces. You do say that you were looking for autonomy and intimacy, which is, I think, what everybody looks for in a relationship.
Mm-hmm.
But it sounded like, at least at that point in your life, you couldn't have that with Alan.
Right, or I didn't know how. I didn't see models that were appealing to me for, you know, ways in which people were married that retained their own independence, I guess. So I wanted to, it felt very important to me that I learn how to be alone, that I learn how to be independent and take care of myself financially and emotionally before I sign on with a man.
And you write a little bit about your mother, your parents, the kind of family that you grew up in. How would you say your parents' relationship influenced yours?
Oh, gosh, that's such a good question. My parents had a very solid egalitarian relationship. So they both worked. My father is a lawyer. My mother was a freelance writer also. They had a great partnership. They were both very involved politically in our town. And so in certain ways, they were a very strong and positive model for me, but it was also a pretty unromantic model.
Mm.
And it wasn't until she died when I was 23, and afterward, I learned more about from my father about how their marriage wasn't as happy as it had seemed, and that definitely shaped me. I mean, in a more emotional, psychological way. I'm talking about in the article about the political and social and economic forces that shaped my decision, but what I don't get into at all are the very personal, psychological reasons that all made me feel kind of scared of marriage when I was in my 20s.
Well, you even describe, and I don't want to get too deep in the personal stuff here, but I thought it was an interesting comment that your mother would try to break up relationships that you were in, and I didn't understand. Why did she do that? And they seemed like perfectly good people.
I know. My brother and I were just talking about that yesterday, and he was saying he thought that was partly she just had a flair for tactless comments.
Oh,
but
so right.
But I do think that she just didn't want, I was 16 and with this boyfriend. We stayed together for 4.5 years, I think. And I think she just was really afraid that I would get married too young, and she wanted me to be able to take advantage of the opportunities that young women have today.
Do you want to be married today?
I feel really mixed about it. I think it sounds like a really nice way to live. And I do, statistically, happily married people are the happiest people out there. But I feel very happy and comfortable with the fact that I haven't married yet. Because if I had, I would have married wrong, is how I see it.
Oh, interesting. And what, I mean, Alan would have been the wrong person?
Yeah. I think, we were great friends and very happy in certain ways, but we were also too young and not really emotionally prepared for that kind of commitment to another person, and I don't think we would have grown as individuals in the ways in which we have, and we've remained very close friends, and Alan is very happily married to a wonderful woman right now, and they have 2 children, and I think it really worked out for the best for both of us. What I wanted at that point in our lives was independence and to learn how to be by myself. And Alan was ready for marriage and the next thing and was able to find that with somebody else.
And I should add, and I thought this was just a very nice point, which is that you went with Alan when he was looking for, what, a tuxedo for his wedding.
Yeah. Yeah. That was one of the nicest, that was his then-fiancé said to him one day, Alan, what are you wearing to our wedding? And he said, I don't know yet. And she said, well, what I think you should do is call Kate and ask her if she will bring you shopping to find the suit. And
wow.
It was one of the most generous things anyone's ever said to me. It was such a beautiful way of including me in their wedding, which is a place that I had no place, I didn't belong there. And it was a really nice way for me to be part of a very important moment in Alan's life.
You talk about some of these forces that are at play that you think are affecting women like you. One is that more women are graduating from college with bachelor's degrees or master's degrees than men. Can you expand on that just a little bit more?
Why they're doing that? I mean, certainly women have been encouraged, over my lifetime, there's been a lot of emphasis on encouraging women. And, I don't know the reasons why men are under-earning in college and grad school. I don't know the answers to that.
But at the same time, what we're seeing is that more women are graduating from college, obviously, with more of an education than men, generally speaking. And the better education you have, I guess the more money you could potentially make.
Yes, certainly. And this economy is very disposed toward people with degrees. It's much better now to have a college degree than ever before. And in so far as the opportunities that opens up to you and what the world is looking for right now. And last year, in 2010, women earned 60% of all bachelor and master's degrees. Mm-hmm. So it's really significant, this difference between men and women on campuses.
Well, and you say, and this is a loaded word, but you say that for women, I guess, like yourself, there are fewer, quote-unquote, marriageable men. What do you mean by that?
Well, I that's a really loaded thing to say, and I'm very clear in the article that when I say there are fewer marriageable men, quote-unquote, I mean traditionally marriageable men. So traditionally, what a marriageable man has been defined by a man who out-earns his wife in terms of, finances and salary, who is better educated and has higher social standing. So historically, women have looked to men to be superior to them in these specific ways because opportunities were denied to women. So the only ways in which, or the easiest ways in which to achieve those things themselves was to get married. And today, because we have fewer men who are out-earning women, because those power balances are shifting, and because, women are on the ascent in all of these various ways, that changes the definition of what is quote-unquote marriageable. Mm-hmm. So I think it's a very subtle point, and the way I'm seeing it is that this isn't bad news. This doesn't mean there are no good men left or women are having to settle for lesser men. It means that women are enjoying advantages that they haven't had before, and it means that in some cases or more increasingly they are better off than a lot of the men that they're dating. But that doesn't mean that the men are bad by any means. It's just changing that balance.
And let me pick up on several things. One is, that your definition, this traditional definition of marriage, seems really old-fashioned to me. Mm-hmm. I'm old enough to be your mother. I'll just put that out there, okay? But I thought, this is what not just women, but men and women have been dealing with for the last 40 or 50 years, the idea that there can be equality within a relationship, that status isn't just built around the idea that one person makes more money than the other. But do you think this notion of a traditional marriage has hung on in spite of all the efforts to undo it?
Oh, without a doubt. It's astonishing. And, it was astonishing to me in the year 2000 when I was deliberating whether or not to break up with Alan. Like, why was that such a difficult decision for me to make? Mm-hmm. It was the future. It was so retrograde that I was up against these kinds of expectations and stigmas. And you know, just a couple of weeks ago, I was at a dinner seated next to a 52-year-old woman who had just left her husband of 27 years. And she was really terrified and didn't know what to do. And I was really struck by the difference between, you know, how old-fashioned her own model had been, that she'd married this guy when she was very young. She had never worked. She was completely dependent on him financially. Certainly most of my high school class, I grew up in Massachusetts, and everybody got married in their early 20s. A lot of people in this very traditional kind of model. So it does still hold, even though there's been so much progress and movement and talk over the past half century about how marriage is changing. And I think that's part of what really was driving me writing this piece was just bumping up against how strong those ideas are.
And even today.
Today, and that it's just absolutely undeniable now that they don't hold anymore, that they don't make sense, and it's just we've got to clear them out, you know, entirely, but they're still hanging around.
Well, let me pull out a sentence, and it may be unfair because I know you say more than this, but here's a sentence. We're contending with a new dating gap where marriage-minded women are increasingly confronted with either deadbeats or players.
Right, yeah.
Go ahead, Kate.
that's another pretty inflammatory thing to be saying, and it's not that I'm backing away from that comment, but it's the idea there is more that that's increasingly the case, and that it's not that that's the way of the future, but it is true that when we have kind of environments like take the college campus, where right now we have more women than men, we have, I think it's 57% women to 43% men on college campuses, and when numbers are skewed like that, there are a lot of studies that show that specific behaviors, gender interactions take hold, and they're not very advantageous to women. And that's one way of looking at how things are playing out right now.
And about a minute before our break here, the idea is if there are more men and fewer women, that men, in a sense, play around?
Yes, exactly. That men are less liable to commit and to much more prone to taking advantage of the options that they have available to them.
I mean, that seems very evolutionarily based. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, certainly evolutionarily that makes sense.
Well, let's take a very short break and we'll get back to our conversation talking about Kate Bolick's cover story. It's in the November edition of The Atlantic. The article is titled All the Single Ladies, and the cover story says, What Me Marry in Today's Economy? Men Are Falling Apart. What That Means for Sex and Marriage. We're going to take a very short break. I'll get back to our conversation. You've had a little taste of what she's written, much more to talk about, but we're curious about your reaction, your response. Do give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. She's a freelance writer and joins us from Los Angeles, where she lives. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Philadelphia Foundation supports WHYY. The Philadelphia Foundation helps make nonprofits stronger, offering workshops and services designed to increase effectiveness and build the capacity of organizations throughout southeastern Pennsylvania. The Philadelphia Foundation can help you support the organizations you care about today and forever while you receive tax deductions. The Philadelphia Foundation, 215-563-6417 or online at philafound.org.
I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. We're chipping away at our overall goal for the fall membership campaign. We began the day looking for 650 people to make a pledge of support. Many called in during morning edition, and now we want to hear from you. 1-888-345-9499, or you can pledge online at WHYY.org. You know where the money goes. It's invested in programs that you enjoy, like Radio Times, Fresh Air, All Things Considered, Voices in the Family, and more. So join your friends and family and make that pledge of support. Thanks.
Supporting WHYY, Westchester University offers over 150 undergraduate and graduate programs, including a computer science degree certified by the National Security Agency, nationally accredited business programs, and research opportunities like the Liquid Life Laboratory. More details are available online at wcupa.edu. That's online at wcupa.edu.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Kate Bolick about her cover story in the Atlantic Monthly's edition. I guess it's just called the Atlantic's edition, the November edition, the cover story saying, "What Me Marry?" And she explores and explains why many women like her, who are middle-aged and educated and successful, are unmarried. She writes about some of her own relationships and love affairs and how women have surpassed men when it comes to education and how this is impacting the so-called pool of marriageable partners. We're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Kate, this article seems to have generated a fair amount of response. Does that surprise you?
Yes, it did. I knew it would, you know, touch a chord that the topic of single women is an interesting and popular one, but the actual response has been overwhelming to me.
And anything surprise you?
I have received less hate mail than I thought that I would. And I know that in the Atlantic's online comment sections, there's been a lot of, you know, blowback, but I've studiously avoided that arena for the time being. And then in my personal email box and in Facebook, I'm getting tons of messages from men and women of all ages, all around the world, writing their personal stories and why they are single or married, and it's been fascinating.
And I guess there are more single people in this country?
Yeah, we're currently at 50% of the population is single, and only, you know, married households are 48%. So for the first times in history, these numbers are dropping and rising as far as the singles go. So demographically, we live in a completely different universe.
You also write, and there are many provocative, very interesting things in this article. One of the sentences I wrote down, you wrote, "With each passing year, that you are less attracted to a man in your peer group." Now, you're 38 years old. That doesn't seem particularly old to me. But do you feel that passage of time and how, in the heterosexual world, certainly how men and women look at each other?
Yeah, that's such a great question. It's, you know, I don't feel it personally, but I am aware of that kind of rhetoric going on around me. So I do feel like it's something I have to pay attention to, that, you know, that you hear that men are attracted to younger, more fertile women. And so that's a potential reality. I haven't found that to be the case yet in my own life. I have found an interesting thing going on where, you know, the older I get, the more obviously the issue of are you going to have children and when becomes really paramount within a relationship in a way that it's not when you're 25 or 29 or even 32. So that's been interesting to have to contend with. And I think that's another really interesting thing to be thinking about now that we have more single people than ever before, and now that all of us are spending our lives unmarried longer than we spend them married, whether that's because we marry late or because we divorce and are single after that, that we need to really think about what it means to be single and how we conduct our lives, because that's a reality, and it's not a bad reality by any means. But it is a different way of organizing and interacting with your life.
Well, you wrote an interesting piece not so long ago in the New York Times about being an aunt or an auntie. I mean, the idea is that there are ways to, in a sense, be if not a parent, certainly have a relationship with a child includes being an aunt or an uncle in the case of a man.
Certainly. And, you know, in the case with my little niece, Sophie, when she was born, I hadn't been in love for a few years, and I just fell in love with her. I am absolutely infatuated with her, and to be suffused with those kinds of emotions felt so good, and that's what made me start thinking about being an aunt, that, wow, I had no idea that this would be so rewarding and exciting to me, and wait a minute, why am I obsessing over finding the right man or, you know, falling in love with the right person? Love comes in so many different shapes and forms, and it doesn't mean that there's no one way of finding and feeling love in your life. We get it in a lot of different ways, and I think we need to be just more open and aware of that for you know, just emotional health rather than putting all of our eggs in one basket.
But is this something that you and your female friends that are essentially your age and in your situation, is this what you talk about when you get together?
Yeah, well, you know, I'd say that for one of the things that started me thinking about this article is that I'd gotten so tired of the conversations that go on when you're a single woman. You mm-hmm. spend so much time with your single woman friends talking about why you're single or, you know, rehashing whatever is going on in your romantic life or figuring out how to meet the next person. And, you know, I think that's all kind of interesting and exciting for, you know, number of years, and then it just gets exhausting and really boring. And I started to feel like, what is wrong with us? Why are we thinking about this and talking about it all the time? We lead really full lives. There's so much more going on in our lives outside of the search for the right person. And why don't we stop thinking and devoting so much airtime to that and just relax into our lives as we know them? Does that make sense?
It does. Is that something you and your friends are able to do, or does the hunt feel like a subtext of some sort?
No, I'd say without a doubt, I've watched all of us as we moved into moved past our mid-30s and into our late-30s, I've watched everyone become more relaxed. It's like we got past this hurdle and things hadn't worked out the way that we thought that they were supposed to work out, and then we realized that we actually felt completely fine about that. And it's been very liberating. And it's been so fun to watch friends come into their own in a different way.
But it seems, especially in, you know, what year is this, 2011? I mean, it seems like there's so many ways to have a relationship with somebody.
Yeah.
I mean, there's so many, and maybe it's overwhelming because there's so many options out there. But it seems that it's so much easier to move beyond those traditional definitions of, if not a marriage, a relationship.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I think that the women who are in their late 20s right now are better at it, from what I can tell. I see myself as the first wave of this transitional generation where the realities that we're living are completely different than those of our mothers, but we still are carrying around those kind of old-fashioned expectations, not as rigidly, but they still exist. And even though what's playing out in front of us are all kinds of varieties of ways of being with people, and certainly the kind of mainstreaming of gay marriage and relationships has been really beneficial for the heterosexual world. I think that it's brought to light a lot more creativity about ways in which to partner up.
Well, in fact, I thought that was an interesting part of the article, saying that there are possible ways to reinvent this notion of marriage, and that gay couples can show other couples a different way to do a relationship.
Exactly. It's pretty amazing to think that the rise of gay marriage is intersecting with all of these other demographics in the straight community right now, and that we can look at the most recent past of the gay world and in the ways in which they've arranged that, you know, choosing friends for family, you know, so many people had to deal with their family shunning them because they came out, and so had to create very strong friend communities to replace their family communities. And so they have a much more sophisticated way of thinking about friendship and dealing with friendship than a lot of straight people do.
And that's Kate Bolick joining us today on Radio Times, talking about a very interesting article, the November cover story in The Atlantic. The article is titled All the Single Ladies, and the magazine on the front has a picture of our guest with the question, "What me marry?" And it has generated a lot of buzz, raised a lot of really interesting questions. We are talking about today on Radio Times, and we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. We're interested in how you're resonating with what we're talking about. Let me get, looks like Charlie from Cherry Hill to join us. And Charlie, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
You're welcome.
A lot of what Kate said really resonated. I'm 50 years old, and I just married a woman who was 49, has never been married, and, you know, really echoes a lot of what I'm hearing from Kate. She was living her life. She was close once. Right after college, and it just that didn't work out. He wasn't the right guy, and you know, I on our first date, as I really started to recognize what a really spectacular person she was, I asked her, so what am I missing? What's wrong? How have you stayed available all this time? And she's, you know,
what'd she
career
say?
And it was just never the right guy and all this kind of stuff. And I'm the luckiest man in the world because she's a spectacular individual, and we're building a great life together. But I also have I was divorced when my children were 10 and 14. I have two daughters. I've been divorced about 10 years, and I sometimes worry that I've done a disservice to them because I've made them kind of hard on men. I don't want them to settle for just a guy with a job. I don't, you know, my new wife is better educated than I am. She's probably earning more earned more than I have over her lifetime, even though we're very close to parity right now. But I feel like I've maybe done a disservice to my kids because I've made them very strong, independent women. And I don't want them just settling for a guy just to have a guy.
Well, Charlie, I really appreciate your call to Radio Times. You touched on many things, and I'm sure Kate wants to weigh in as well. Kate, go ahead.
Yeah, well, sir, it's so interesting you say that about your daughters, and I've found that again and again when I've met men who are the primary caretakers and have raised daughters, that the girls are very independent, and that's just a completely excellent thing, obviously. Mm-hmm. And also, what your situation brings to light how increasing gender parity or women making more than men is something that men and women are really comfortable with, which is really nice, too.
Well, I love his question where he said to his then future wife, you know, what's wrong with you? Or, you know, is there something I'm missing here? And here she is, 49 and never married.
Yeah. And just even that, you know, that what's wrong with you phrasing is another weird epidemic that we pathologize women who aren't married, and women pathologize themselves. You know, there's just, you know, aisles bursting with self-help literature where women are forced to, you know, look at themselves, what's wrong with them, why aren't they getting a guy, what do they have to do to change themselves, and just to remove all of that, to say nothing's wrong with you, you know, that you are the beneficiary of a lot of large social forces that have made you able to not have to make compromises you don't want to make. It's just a positive thing.
Charlie, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Kate, near the end of your article, then we'll get back to our callers, you go to Amsterdam where they have an apartment house there. Can you describe that for our listeners?
Oh, God, that was amazing. A friend had tipped me off to it. I was looking, as I was researching the article, I was thinking about times in American history when we have had a surplus of single women that has felt threatening to the larger population. And so I was thinking about urban areas at the turn of the century when women were moving to cities and taking jobs, and that was a very scary time for people. People didn't know what to do with single women. And so one solution was to house them in single-sex residential hotels, and which don't exist. Or, I mean, they kind of do exist, but not at all in the same way that they once did. And I had been thinking about how that was kind of neat that back, you know, now we've become so modern that we're all very atomized, and now that it's okay for women to live alone, we all live very alone, and I think it can get pretty lonely. It's lonely to live alone for too long, and so I started thinking about ways in which to revive old practices, and a friend tipped me off to this place in Amsterdam that has been in existence since medieval times. It started out as a complex. It wasn't nuns. They weren't a religious order, but it was they're religiously affiliated, and they would take care of the sick. But it was single women who lived alone in these lovely little apartments, and it's been in continuous operation since then. So I flew over there to check it out and to see what that kind of living situation would be like. So it's very different than a commune, which, that's another way of looking at it, or some kind of, you know, intentional matriarchal structure. And what it was is this, it's in the middle of the city, middle of downtown Amsterdam, this circle of Dutch houses, you know, they're so charming, and you walk, enclosed by a wall, and you walk through this door, and it's this enchanting courtyard, and flowers tumbling everywhere, and these beautiful, light-filled apartments, each filled with a single woman. So the criteria for moving in are you have to be between the ages of 30 and 65 to apply and take a vow to live alone. So if you have a baby, you have to move out. If you fall in love and want to live with your partner, you have to move out. And it was wonderful.
Oh, it's so interesting. Let me get, looks like Shelby from Wynwood to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Shelby. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. I am 53 years old. My daughter is 25. And so I've looking at it, this issue from, you know, two different perspectives.
Sure.
I was raised in a time where things got really switched around, where you could do anything you wanted, but the expectation was sort of that you would get married and have children. All of the new ways of living, I understand, they resonate, I get it. The only thing I do take exception to is calling the idea of getting married old-fashioned. Because if all the other ways of living are current and modern and today, that should also be included. I think that is as judgmental a piece of this as the issues that people of my age had to go through on making decisions and the people today are going through on how they want to live.
Well, it's interesting, Shelby. Thanks for the call to Radio Times. And I think the point that I was trying to make is that there are just many different ways of being married. I mean, many different ways of being in a relationship and certainly many different ways of being married as well. Kate, you want to weigh in on that?
Yeah, absolutely. I don't see marriage as an old-fashioned idea at all. I think that what I'm trying to say is that there are many ways of doing things and that marriage is one way. And it does happen to be the traditional way. But there's no one way that's better or worse than another.
But, you know, I'm also thinking, and we've done shows about this and it's been written about how men have been hit hard by the economy, for one thing, and have been losing ground. It's been called sometimes the man session because of the kind of jobs that have been hard hit by the economy. And, of course, that can have a kind of tumbling effect on a man. And do you see that in your world, Kate, that the economy has just been hard on everybody, and except for, I guess, the very, very wealthy people in this country, but the kid that men have paid a pretty high price?
Yeah, without a doubt. And I think that, you know, that's something that we're all just still figuring out how to navigate. And, you know, even though this too seems kind of old-fashioned, that I'm always surprised to discover that men do associate their self-worth with their income more than I do. And so they are hit in ways that I can't always comprehend. Or they're experiencing being out of work in a way that's different from the way that I am. And so how couples negotiate that is tricky and something that we all have to learn how to do. And so again, this is, you know, just the world is changing right in front of us, and we don't have ways yet of coping with it. And so this is why these kinds of conversations are important to have, so that we can be aware of these different realities.
Indeed. Well, let's take another short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation talking with Kate Bolick. She's a freelance writer, and she has written a cover story in the November edition of The Atlantic titled What Me Marry. And we are taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Philadelphia Theater Company supports WHYY and welcomes Oscar nominee Haley Joel Osment and Broadway veteran Stephen Rao in the Tony Award-winning Red. Red is a portrait of master abstract expressionist Mark Rothko, who has just landed the biggest commission in the history of the art world, and his young assistant as they work feverishly to create a definitive work of art. Tickets for Red, starting October 14th, are available at 215-985-0420 or philadelphiatheatercompany.org.
I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. We're chipping away at our overall goal for the fall membership campaign. We began the day looking for 650 people to make a pledge of support. Many called in during morning edition, and now we want to hear from you. 1-888-345-9499, or you can pledge online at WHYY.org. You know where the money goes. It's invested in programs that you enjoy, like Radio Times, Fresh Air, All Things Considered, Voices in the Family, and more. So join your friends and family and make that pledge of support. Thanks.
Supporting WHYY, the Center School presents the Parent Education Network, a series of presentations from professionals in the field of developmental pediatrics, learning disabilities, special education law, and family counseling. Raising a Child with Learning Differences, an evening of support and collaboration with Dr. Michael Cassano will be held on Wednesday, November 2nd at 7 p.m. at the school located in Abington. Details are available by contacting Carol Wolf at 215-657-2200 or cwolf at centerschoolpa.org.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Kate Bolick about why many women like her, and we're talking about middle-aged, educated, successful women are single. It's a subject of an article in The Atlantic, the November edition of The Atlantic, called All the Single Ladies, and we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Kate, how would you say the sexual revolution of the 60s has played out for your generation?
I found that to be depressing when I started looking into it and thinking about it. We hear so much about hookup culture on college campuses, which is said to have dawned in the early 1990s when universities stopped acting in loco parentis and kids were drinking a lot and having sex and blah, blah, blah. And I'm all for people being able to do whatever they want to do. I don't feel dogmatic about how we should conduct ourselves sexually at all, but I don't feel convinced that it's been great for young people. It seems to me like there's been a lot of drunken hookups that aren't actually very sexually satisfying and or intimacy building or anything like that. And I know, I say that very authoritatively, and I know very little about it, and a lot of people take issue with my saying that. But that is what I have gleaned. I think the sexual revolution promised so much that has not come to pass, at least in people in their younger lives. I think that people are generally pretty inexperienced and having casual, frequent sex because they think that they're supposed to, and that's what everybody else is doing, and it's been really complicated.
Well, in fact, you say, and you interviewed some, I guess, college students, young people, and they talked about having not very exciting or sensual experience of sex, but they had the technical know-how.
Right.
But they knew
right.
how to do things, but they weren't necessarily enjoying it as much as they had hoped.
Exactly. Yeah, I was really surprised to discover that these young women had a very specific kind of experience, but not the wisdom that comes with experience.
You feel old saying that?
Yes. I feel really old doing this whole article.
That's very funny. If you think you feel old, don't even ask me how old I feel. Let me get looks like Dana from South Philadelphia to join us. And Dana, go ahead, you're on Radio Times.
Hi.
Hi there.
I want to thank Kate for writing this article. I'm a 44-year-old single woman. I've never been married, was almost there, once in my 20s, once in my 30s, two separate men. I would have been divorced twice. Mm. And I'm very happy. I own a home. I own my own business. And I'm in the bridal industry, so I'm with brides every weekend. And many are very young, 22, 23, and sometimes inside of me, I'm just screaming, saying, what's the rush? What's the rush? They haven't even left the country. They've never, one woman, she dated the same guy through junior high school, and she never experienced another guy before. And I just thought, there's a lot to life, and you need to sort of take a bite out of it. And I'm just happy I took the path that I have, and I'm just so happy that people are writing about it.
Well, that's great, Dana. Let me give Kate a chance to weigh in on your comments. Thanks for calling into Radio Times. Kate, go ahead.
Yeah, that's a great. I just love the idea of you being at this bridal shop.
Yes, exactly.
It's a great image. It calls to mind two things for me. One is that, this matrimania, we are at this cultural moment where weddings have taken on such a crazy outsized degree of importance, and it's impossible not to think that it's directly inversely correlated to these changing marriage times, that we're clinging to a fantasy harder than we ever have before, and that it's a way of staving off the uncertainty that our realities are actually presenting us with. It's much more comforting to think about your adult life when you can picture yourself wearing a dress and walking down the aisle, and it seems all so tied up so neatly in a bow. And then also the other thing that made me think about just listening to you was this idea of experience versus inexperience. And that's something else I think we all need to be thinking really deeply about is when I left Allen at age 28 and was embarking on this more intentional period of being single, I unquestioningly thought that the more experience I had, the better I would be. And I feel a little ambivalent about that now in retrospect. I think experience is a great thing and I wouldn't turn it in, but I do wonder if culturally we oddly sort of over-prioritize that. It's
Do you mean you get more set in your ways, or there's something about novelty that isn't as exciting? Or
there's something about experience for the sake of experience can become empty after a while. Mm. And this is, I'm kind of talking off the top of my head right here. I haven't thought this all the way through, but I think that women like myself have unquestioningly thought that the more experience we have, the better we are. And I do wonder if there's a way in which that becomes a little detrimental or repetitive at some point.
Well, it seems to me if the goal is self-improvement, then maybe not so much. But if you're just a curious person and have opportunities and want to see the world, I mean, it seems to me that would be a good thing for anybody.
Right, exactly. I know. I shouldn't be talking off the top of my head before I sorted out my thoughts.
I know the feeling, believe me. Dana, thanks for the call. Let's get Mary from Westchester to join our conversation. And Mary, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi there.
Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
This subject is one I've thought about a great deal. I was married traditionally for 28 years, had three kids. That marriage ended in divorce. Then I married again, traditionally, to a wonderful man who has since passed away. I am now 66 and in a relationship that I think really calls up our questions about what does a committed relationship mean in its many different incarnations. So at the age of 66, my lover and boyfriend is 15 years younger. Mm. He lives in Vermont. We are from very profoundly different educational, socioeconomic backgrounds, and yet somehow this relationship works. Mm. And so we talk to each other twice a day, share late-breaking news. We have a wonderful love life. I go up there as frequently as I can, and it bears almost no relationship to my previous two marriages. And yet, at this stage of my life, this works.
Oh, that's great. Mary, that's a great phone call. Again, because it taps into so many things that we're talking about and raises other questions as well. And let me give Kate a chance to weigh in on that, too.
Yeah, I mean, can I ask a question
Absolutely.
Back here?
Sure, go ahead.
So, I mean, are you finding that in those previous marriages that you were kind of going marriage first, like more toward a model or a mode rather than responding to the relationship itself? And that
certainly
this
in the first one, I married just on the cusp of the women's movement. And so at that time, in the late 60s, early 70s, marriage was an institution that we just stepped into and we didn't question it at all. It just was what you did. Mm-hmm. And after that marriage ended, I spent a long time. I actually wrote an outline for a book called Getting Off the Merry-Go-Round that was a deconstruction of what we mean by marriage at the late 20th century. Mm-hmm. And when I completed the thinking for that, I never actually got around to publishing it. I think once I was done with the thinking, I was done with the book.
I know that feeling as well, yes.
After I completed that, the next marriage was very much more mindful, even though on the surface it looked traditional. Mm-hmm. We lived together, we shared our social lives, we were of approximately the same age and financial and educational background. So on the surface it looked to be, quote-unquote, a traditional marriage. But underneath, that marriage was the product of all of this thinking and pondering that I had done over the years. When he passed away, I was suddenly in my 60s. Mm. and the terrain, the landscape of relationships had changed radically from the time I married for the second time. I was in my early 50s until now, when you know, many of my friends are widowed. Many of them have husbands whose health is going deteriorating rapidly. So even if there were men in my age group, many of them, most of them, are married and in declining health.
Well, Mary, let me just jump in here, because I want to give Kate a chance to weigh in, and we've got a couple of other callers as well. But you know what? It's a fascinating story, and Kate, I'd be curious about your response.
Well, I mean, mostly I want you to write that book so I can read it. You've got a fascinating perspective.
Well, but I think it also taps into the fact that people are, Mary's a good example of this, people are creative, or they can be creative, you know, under certain circumstances. And maybe for her, it took a lot of thinking and writing to work her way to the relationship that she has now. But I like the creative bent that she's on.
Yeah, same here.
Let me see what looks like Dana has to say. And Dana joining us from South Philadelphia. Hi, Dana. Go ahead. You're on the air. No? Sorry. Let me just give out that phone number again. And it's one. Sorry about that. I just got a little lost on the computer here. 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. What do you hope your article does?
I would like for my article just to get people thinking about how they think about their romantic lives, rather than doing it unquestioningly.
And have you seen that in terms of the kind of email response that you've gotten? Do you see people, as we're hearing, I think, with our callers, people thinking and talking through what they have done with their lives?
Oh, definitely. It's so exciting to read these emails, because you can just tell. I mean, people, they're writing these long confessional emails, and they're doing it because they're working out their ideas as they write to me, you know? So there's so many different access points to this idea. So you can think about it in so many different ways, and it's really exciting that people are, and that they want to be having this kind of conversation.
So are you okay if you do get married, if you don't get married, if you, whatever that future holds for you, are you okay with that?
Yeah, I mean, the way I see it at this point, at least, is, you know, I'm a passionate person. I've had love before. I will have love again, and I will, you know, form the kind of relationship that my intended, whoever he may be, and I, you know, decide that we want together. But I feel it's about, my responsibility is to make my life as full and stable and fulfilling as it possibly can be, so that I can share myself with another and be genuinely committed to another in a way that I don't think I was able to do when I was younger. I take the vow of marriage very seriously, and if I do it, I'll be doing it, mm-hmm. you know, 150%. So I haven't wanted to enter into something so serious until I knew I could do it.
And that's, again, Kate Bolick, our guest today on Radio Times, talking about the cover story of the November edition of The Atlantic. And it's the cover story says, What Me Marry. I'm Marty Moscoane, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY.
And I'm Dave Davies here, along with Ed Cunningham, coming to you for what we are confident will be the last time this year to ask you to sustain and support Marty and all the terrific other shows that you hear on WHYY. Easy to do. You pick up the phone and make a call and make a pledge at 1-888-345-9499. Or online at WHYY.org. Now, Ed Cunningham, I just want to tell our audience that it sounded quiet during the last break.
Oh, yeah, that's
and that's
deceiving.
because we're in a different studio where we don't hear the phones ring. We do
right.
hear the web pings.
Yes, we do.
But we had some terrific results, and we're right on the verge here.
We are. It was something along the lines of 170-something pledges short of reaching our goal when we were with you an hour ago. And lo and behold, we are now told we're now down to 88 pledges short of ending this membership drive. And as we indicated earlier, Dave, I think it's only appropriate that this membership drive should end and have a big final flourish around Radio Times, which Philadelphia Magazine has called the best radio program in Philadelphia. So do you agree? Do you want to end this with a flourish for Marty? Well, here's what you do. You dial us up, 1-888-345-9499. That's toll-free, 1-888-345-WHYY. We won't hear those phones ring, as Dave pointed out, but yes, we will hear the web pledges. We'll hear them ping at WHYY.org. Dave, we've got 3.5 minutes left. If we can pick up those final 80-some pledges, it's all over, and it's a great tribute to Marty.
I feel like a marathon runner staggering toward or sprinting toward the finish line, and I hope you feel that way as well. You know, Marty does pay attention to this, and we hope you appreciate what she does. You know, earlier in this hour, we heard three new members of the School Reform Commission talk about the daunting task of improving education in this city, restoring credibility to the School Reform Commission, and now a completely different turn where Marty and her producers find people who have interesting things to say about love, life, and relationships in a changing society, and Marty brings out their perspectives in such an interesting way. And let me just suggest to you that I know many of my friends and many of you listening think of yourselves as real supporters of public radio, and you know, you've given, and then if you think about it sometimes, you think, well, actually, I'm not a current member. Actually, now that I think about it, they were doing the Macarena last time I gave. If that's the case, it's time to update your support. And what a terrific time. You can get a game-winning hit here. We are that close to the end of this thing, and we're going to go off. We're going to stop this. You're going to hear Talk of the Nation fresh air uninterrupted if we get the 85 or so pledges that we need. I'm assuming it's much less than that now, Ed.
Yeah, that's right. It's that last check I saw, it's been down to 80 and lower. But see, the problem is we don't know about the phone pledges. We can't keep direct track of that. That's just the way it works right now at 1-888-345-9499. So unfortunately, we can't give you a final flourish announcement at 12 noon that we've done it for Marty. But if you hear the rest of our schedule this afternoon, as you say, Talk of the Nation, Fresh Air, All Things Considered, if you hear that without interruption, you'll know why, because you did it. You did it around Radio Times. You were talking about that discussion about the school reform.